It's an unusual day of late when some item featuring the words Mexican and border does not make the news. We'll point straight at that subject area in this hour in a visit with someone who worked hard for several years to find the people behind the statistics, the people who try so hard to get into the United States, and the many who do only to get sent back to Mexico. They are the subjects of Jeremy Slack's book, Deported to Death, How Drug Violence is Changing Migration on the U.S.-Mexico Border. Jeremy Slack is an assistant professor of geography at the University of Texas at El Paso. Jeremy is a co-editor of a previous book, The Shadow of the Wall, Violence and Migration on the U.S.-Mexico Border. Jeremy Slack, welcome.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So is it possible to live in El Paso and be oblivious to the border, Jeremy?
No. You know, this is one of these communities that would blow away in the desert if it weren't for the border. We're so intimately connected from one side of the border to the next. Families, friends, businesses, entertainment, everything revolves on going back and forth across the border. So this is really an excellent place for me to live.
All right. So you really get a good look at what goes on over there. What did you set out to do with this book?
So this book is a result of, you know, about 10 years of field work. Essentially, it began when I was in graduate school. We were doing a project surveying people about what it's like to cross the border and be returned to Mexico. And during that time period was when we started to see this violence explode along the border, right? You started to see these horrific executions. We had several shootouts near where we were doing work, things that were really very terrifying. And one of the things that I noticed doing this research was that the people that were crossing the border had a very unique exposure to this type of violence. And so basically what I did is really try and pursue that. We conducted a very large survey up and down the U.S.-Mexico border, but there were a lot of unanswered questions, right? A lot of things that were too dangerous to put on a black and white survey. And so I spent years conducting interviews, living and working in migrant shelters in places like Tamaulipas that are famous for having migrant massacres, to really understand things like why would drug cartels, you know, formerly well known for having such ostentatious lifestyles, really focus on migrants? What would they care about these relatively poor people? Why so much kidnapping? Why so much disappearance?
And that's the thing I really want people to understand is why is that vulnerability unique to the migrant? Can you expand on that concept?
Yeah, so what I argue in my book is that a lot of this is because this is a massive group of people. You know, we're talking about at least 500,000 people a year deported to Mexican border cities. And they're very much out of place, right? These aren't people that are in a final destination, and they're nowhere near their home. You know, I think one of the things about deportation that people should really be aware is it's not like we're sending people home, right? If it would be as if somebody, you know, dropped one of your Oregon listeners off in El Paso and said, okay, you're home now. Thousands and thousands of miles away, right? These are notoriously dangerous places. And so they arrive in this place and they're very much exposed. They don't know where to go. They often don't have identification. Many people haven't been back to that country in 20 years or even within, you know, their memory. Some people 3 or 4 years old when they left. And so this is a group of people that A, is presumed to have money because they have some ties to the United States, and B, they're thought to be vulnerable, right? There's no one there that's going to protect them, and they're easy picking.
And you mentioned a massacre. Let's talk about that, the massacre of the 72 in 2010. Where did that happen?
This happened in San Fernando, Tamaulipas. It was really a shocking event in this kind of first period of Mexico's drug war, when about 72 migrants were shot and left in an abandoned building, lined up, executed. They were all from Central American and South American countries. And to this day, not even all of them have been identified.
So did that bring about some changes? Did the massacre institute any changes in policy on either side of the border?
Short answer, no. You know, in the following years after the massacre, we found several mass graves in the area. About 200 bodies were dug up in that same place. No major changes have happened. And in fact, in the United States, what we started to do during that same period was really escalate the number of people deported to that state. So we found a confusing trend where there was about 70,000 more people deported to Tamaulipas, the state with the massacre, after the massacre than were apprehended there, right? So people cross the border and they usually get apprehended and sent back to where they crossed. But we found this strange mismatch where a lot of people were being sent there even though they didn't cross there.
And you noticed, you mentioned in the writing here that there was a real difference in the feeling on the streets between El Paso and Nuevo Laredo, one of the major cities of Tamaulipas, in 2010. What was the difference you had there?
Yes, well, particularly when you compare a lot of these border cities, you know, Ciudad Juarez, our sister city here in El Paso, was very famous for drug violence, right? There was more than 10,000 people murdered in a five-year period here. But the difference for me is conducting research in Juarez versus in Tamaulipas was that it was much less organized and controlled. You know, in Tamaulipas was this place that was controlled by the notorious Zetas cartel, and there were lookouts everywhere. You would see people on the streets. You would hear people talking on radios, reporting who is coming and going. The simple act of walking from one plaza to the next, one street to the next, would get people followed. I had a very difficult time, you know, moving around and working in these places without being followed or sometimes threatened. So it made it a very difficult place to work. And frankly, you know, this is a place where there is very limited journalism. The other faculty I know there had stopped doing any research related to migration because they were too afraid. You couldn't even get a newspaper from across the border delivered to you, because the person doing that had been threatened. So it was a place where information was very, very controlled. And we see this kind of ebbing and flowing in a lot of these border cities. There are times when they really want to make sure that they control everything that happens, they meaning organized crime.
So when we hear about stories like the massacre of 72 people in 2010 and then other subsequent large-scale killings of human beings on the Mexican side, I mean, you wonder about what's being done on the Mexican side to get things under control. You do point out the fact that the Mexican military has gotten much more involved in law enforcement. I mean, so what's the relationship between military and police, and who's doing which job?
Frankly, it's very complicated. Something that's in a lot of flux right now with the new president in Mexico, who had kind of made a promise to pull back from this militarized approach to citizen security. But in a lot of the places I worked, for example, the entire police force was arrested or sequestered simply because they were considered too corrupt and the military took over. But the problem is that militaries really are not trained to do policing jobs. You know, militaries are there to kill enemies. You know, this is one of the reasons why in the United States we're very careful about allowing the military to operate on national soil. The idea that a military can take over functions such as taking police reports, investigating crimes, providing security for people is not very well thought out. And so there is a lot of tension between these different branches of law enforcement and military about who is supposed to be fighting this war on drugs that is increasingly unpopular.
And then in terms of services available for people like the ones you followed here who are trying to reestablish themselves in Mexico or just find their way when they were pushed across the border and left there, is there any real safety net for them, official one anyway, a government one?
I mean, it varies by region to region. The major, the most common services are half price off of a bus ticket to wherever they're from in Mexico. But this becomes a real problem for people that don't have the other half. And one of the big issues is that we found that about a quarter of the people that were carrying identification lost it in the process of being, you know, going through being apprehended by Border Patrol and being returned to Mexico. And so you have large groups of people that don't have any identification, therefore they can't receive money transfers, they can't get out of these places. There are also either some government-funded, but usually private or religious organizations that will provide people a couple nights of shelter. But the big desire of many of these states and border cities has been to get people out of the border cities as fast as possible, right? Because they know that this is something where you'll start to see increases in kidnapping, increases in extortion, And often, frankly, you'll see people being coerced into joining and working for organized crime, which makes the situation even more difficult.
All right, so a couple of things we need to understand here. Again, when people are deported, they are just deported across the border. It is not like they are sent back to their original cities. They just get shoved across to the Mexican side and bye-bye. Is that it?
Right. The vast majority are just driven up to the border and told to walk across the bridge, and that's it.
All right, so there's an ethical consideration you bring up here revolving around the criminalization of attempted immigration, sending incarcerated people back across the border and essentially washing our hands of it on the American side. How do you think it should be handled?
Certainly, this is a very complicated area. I mean, we typically didn't treat crossing the border as a criminal offense until really about 2006 or 2007.
And I want to make it clear, this is not a Trump-bashing book purely. This is the criminalization obviously precedes the current president.
Oh, of course. I mean, I think a lot of the groundwork for the problems that we're seeing today started under Clinton, continued by Bush, and certainly taken to a new extreme by Obama. There's plenty of blame to go around. It's nonpartisan. But this issue of sending people to prison, federal prison, for crossing the border really ramped up until it became the most common federal charge. And this is something that's generally considered a misdemeanor and, frankly, was something that just wasn't prosecuted until fairly recently. Now, we see this combined with other issues that actually came about during the Clinton era, which is the increased ease with which people can have residency and other forms of legal documentation to be in the United States removed. And so often you'll see people that have extremely close ties to the United States being convicted of several crimes, most of them not very severe, and being removed to a country where they no longer have any family, any ties, any life set up.
Jeremy Slack, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, his book is Deported to Death, How Drug Violence is Changing Migration on the U.S.-Mexico Border. Pause for a moment, if you would, Jeremy, to separate border crossers from asylum seekers. These are still separate categories, at least on paper, but have they in essence merged?
In some ways, yes. You know, I think one of the big things for people to understand is that the flows of Mexican migrants were very rarely asking for asylum. Most people were either economic or family driven in the reason that they crossed the border initially. And so these are people that were seeking to evade authorities to cross the border illegally. Whereas asylum seekers behave in a very different manner, right? Asylum seekers either want to go to the port of entry and present themselves, or they want to cross the border and flag down a Border Patrol agent with whom they are legally allowed to apply for asylum and simply claim fear in their home countries. Now, this is changing quickly. You know, we've very much changed the way that we treat asylum in the last, well, I would say 6 months, but really the last year. And creating a new situation that is one that's deeply terrifying to me, which is this process of sending people who are seeking asylum back to wait in these border cities. So we have about 25,000 people who came to the U.S., claimed asylum, and now been sent back to Mexico to wait. And the situation is becoming increasingly dire. People don't have access to housing. Many people are being kidnapped, extorted. We've already had several asylum seekers murdered here in Juarez, and this is becoming a very, very dangerous situation. It's essentially as if someone took all of the issues that I write about in my book and threw gasoline on that fire. It's very scary.
But as you point out, there was a fire going on already. The CDS, the Consequence Delivery System, what is that?
So this is this strategic plan from the United States Border Patrol, which is to really increase the amount of consequences that people face for undocumented immigration. So first offenders often are just returned to Mexico, and then there is an increase in both criminal penalties, where upon reentry charges can carry a sentence up to 20 years. Now, I've never seen anyone actually sentenced to 20 years, but I frequently send people 6 or 7 years to prison for simply crossing the border. Other people are sent to different region of the border. This is called lateral repatriation. So somebody crosses through here in El Paso, and they're sent to Tijuana, on the border of California, or down to South Texas. And there's a various different ways in which it's a much more complicated set of criminal charges that actually make it much more, the penalties are much greater for immigration often than doing something like trafficking drugs, right? And so in many ways, you're pushing these different activities together, this activity of drug trafficking, working for organized crime, making that more attractive and pushing people who were mainly undocumented immigrants before.
But it seems like the name is pretty explanatory, the consequence delivery system, to make, as President Trump has said many times, and his supporters as well, that the idea is to make it unpleasant. I mean, if you're going to try to come into this country, you're going to pay some penalties.
That's correct. And I mean, one of the things we have to ask ourselves, though, is at what level, you know, especially when we're talking about asylum seekers, which is something that we agreed after World War II, we wouldn't send people back until they've had their hearings. At what point does punishing people by making them wait or returning them to these dangerous places actually decrease the security along the border, which I think is something that we can all agree is of utmost importance? At what point does this process of trying to give people consequences to punish them for trying to come here actually work at cross purposes?
Jeremy Slack, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He works at the University of Texas at El Paso. He's written a book based on many years of interviewing people along the border called Deported to Death: How Drug Violence is Changing Migration on the U.S.-Mexico Border. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And just to restate the issue here, we have people who are vulnerable because they are on the move, don't have a base of operations, have been sent back across the border. They don't want to be in Mexico. They are not particularly wanted on the Mexican side. They're certainly not wanted on the American side, which, as you point out, makes them targets for organized crime. So you talk to a lot of people in shelters. This is where you found most of the people you interviewed for the book?
Yes. Shelters were a great place for me to do research, because typically what happens is once people are removed, they're driven to these shelters and they're not allowed to leave. Often there's no cell phones allowed. There's really nothing to do once people get a shower and get some food. So it's kind of a captive audience, a great place to meet people, and people are very receptive to talking about their experiences. Often because what they would tell me is that, you know, they don't want to talk to the other people they're with because they've all had the same experiences, and they don't want to tell their families because they're afraid of worrying them.
The book begins with stories of people taken from shelters by criminals. Did you find that to be a frequent occurrence, or could you even find out how frequent it was?
It's a good question. It's frequent enough that almost every shelter in the Northeast had some similar experience. It's often a hidden secret. A lot of these shelters don't want that publicized for obvious reasons, right? They want to, you know, they want to keep operating. They want to be seen as safe. However, they really don't have the resources to protect themselves. So it is certainly a bit of a catch-22. You know, the new director of one of the shelters where I worked was kidnapped and hasn't been seen in several weeks because he tried to stop people from taking Cuban asylum seekers, from abducting Cuban asylum seekers that were staying at the shelter. And so it is very dangerous for people to try and intervene and stop people from being taken. One of the really heartbreaking things for a lot of the people that work there, that care about immigrants, that are trying to help them, and they watch them be taken at gunpoint and can't do anything about it.
Are the shelters themselves seen as something contemptible by the general public, the people who live in the cities where the shelters are located?
It's certainly complicated. I think most people see them as a good work. Typically, they're religious, right? So they're typically Catholic organizations, and so there's a certain amount of good faith towards them. However, I do notice that there's often a not in my backyard symptom going on, where people are supportive of them as long as they're not close by.
Hmm.
And so you often see the shelters located in poorer, often dangerous, more dangerous parts of town because they would attract less attention there than they would if they were in a more wealthy neighborhood, unfortunately.
So you mentioned the migrants would rather talk to you in some cases than to the people in the shelters with them because they have very similar stories. But you also point out that like any group, as we define groups, it's not monolithic. And you say there are stories here to disappoint people both on the left and the right.
Of course. I mean, I did my best to find as many different types of people as possible. You know, we would have people involved in smuggling, people involved in drug trafficking. You know, I'm a social scientist, so I try and I do a lot of work to try and suspend a value judgment, right? To see is this person good or bad, but rather see what's behind. What are the structures that would lead somebody who was once an economic migrant into criminal activities and vice versa, right?
Well, and then some of the stories of the people who got into drug trafficking, my jaw dropped at reading that the drug carriers tried to unionize.
Yes. This is a fascinating story. In the town of Altar, Sonora, there was, you know, typically a lot of the people there that would smuggle drugs were actually field hands. They were agricultural workers, and they would be offered, you know, several months' wages to take a backpack for a week. But the problem began that they were often not being paid. They were told that they had to take another load to get paid. And because of this either lack of payment or reduced payment, they got so angry that they decided to unionize and try and threaten the much more powerful drug traffickers. They wouldn't take drugs if they didn't have a clear arrangement. Really a fascinating way to understand just how open and how benign drug trafficking is often seen in parts of the Mexican border. And drugs are typically seen as something that is the gringos' problem. It's U.S. problem.
Well, it is heading to an American market where there's demand for it.
It's true. And so, you know, they see that as the customers. You know, what's the harm if I take these drugs across and people want it there?
So you've got not only the drug trafficking going on, but as you point out, when the people are told, no, you have to go again, and then we'll pay you, and then this happens a few more times, this is really human trafficking, too. Now, in the places where people might look for some support, you know, some refuge from government, as you point out, non-state structures of power, i.e. cartels, generally rule, as you point out. But how are these related to the state structures of power? How much are they intertwined with each other?
Quite extensively. I mean, you know, Mexico is a very sophisticated country, especially in terms of corruption. I mean, I will be clear. I love Mexico. My wife is from Mexico. I spend many, many years there. But there is a very subtle way in which corruption has been allowed to function in Mexico, whereupon it almost works as a tax system with illegal organizations, where people, drug trafficking organizations, attempt to pay the highest amount of bribes. And the people that are on the top are allowed to continue operating, whereas the people on bottom are going to be arrested and paraded in front of the cameras as if this is a big, big victory. When we know that time and again, essentially, these bribes are like their taxes, and it allows for them to operate in pretty much complete impunity, especially in some of these areas that are outside of the view of many people, right? A remote town like Altar wasn't known for anything until it became kind of the hub of migrant smuggling along the border.
All right, so they parade out the people on the lower end. We found the corrupt people. Now we'll be able to clean this organization up when the people at the top are still on the take, so that doesn't change much there. Now, as far as the migrants get dealt with, it sounds like they get scapegoated in other ways too, just by the regular folks in addition to the people in the cartels.
Yes, I mean, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about before with this criminalization. There still is an idea in Mexico that if you're removed, you were probably up to no good, that you were doing something wrong, whereas it's gotten much and much, much easier to be removed. You know, driving without a license will get you deported in many places where you can't get a license if you're undocumented. Other times, you know, people that have papers can be removed for a DUI, other issues that, you know, while serious, aren't what we would consider a criminal mastermind. And so there is a perception in a lot of these border towns that deportees are up to no good, that they're dangerous, and there is that stigma that tends to follow people. Often for years after being removed, especially people that have set down roots in the United States as being not really Mexican anymore.
Well,
Speak slightly different.
To come back to some of these sheer numbers, where people get deported, you pointed that Nogales, just across from Arizona, had in the year 2007, 129,000 people dropped there through deportation in a city that only has a regular population of 220,000. So that's a huge number of people.
It really is. And I mean, I think, as with a lot of immigration issues, the costs are really borne by a lot of local populations. I mean, one can imagine that having about half the city population dropped off as essentially homeless on the streets, that would create problems anywhere.
All right. So certainly some dangers in the towns you visited. What kind of danger were you in trying to tag along with groups of migrants on the Mexican side?
The biggest challenges I had were working in places like Tamaulipas, where they made it pretty clear that my presence was not welcome. I would try and, you know, do things such as follow people, hang out with them during the day. A lot of the shelters would close during the day and make sure that people go out, you know, look for jobs, do work, or just pass the time. And so what would people do during the day was one of the things I was interested in. I certainly had people following me and made it clear that I was not welcome to do that in certain areas. You know, the whole book, I especially took a lot of care in terms of establishing myself, making sure that people know who I am, what I'm doing, that I'm a researcher.
Not a cop.
And spent a lot of time kind of coming and going and working at these shelters before I would, you know, move in.
And how much similarity of circumstances or not did you find in why people wanted to go north?
It's certainly divided. You know, I think that one of the big things that we saw was that there are certain groups of people that really want to do this as an economic activity. They want to go work a couple years, save up money, go home, buy a ranch, stay in Mexico, right? They really want that. You know, they love Mexico. They love their life there. They love their family there. And then there's another group of people that, whether this was their first intent or not, they have set up their home in the United States. And so one thing that we found is that people who consider the United States their home behave in a very different way, right? They've adapted to the United States, the life here. They probably own property. They often have family. About 23% have U.S. citizen children under the age of 18 of deportees. And so those people are very much not deterred by being sent to jail, being sent to, you know, charged with crimes for crossing the border. And they're going to attempt to go back no matter which way that they can. And this is where you see this very strong pull of family, of home, to coming back to the United States, right? I think one of the things, too, that's always good to remember is that people who are being deported aren't typically, you know, very few of them are coming to the United States for the first time. These are usually people that have been here quite some time, average of about 8 or 9 years living in the United States. That's a significant amount of time. And so those people really are left in this position where they don't know Mexico anymore. They don't have anything waiting for them. And so either they risk their lives by trying to cross the border again, or they attempt to totally relocate their family to a place where they might not have any way to make money. These are tough decisions for anyone.
Sure. So I can see where the ones who got ties to the United States would think there's nothing for me here. So, you know, of course I'm going to go back would be their view of things. I want to talk about some of the people you encountered in certain roles on the Mexican side, halcones and enganchadores. What do they do?
So halcones are typically lookouts. You know, that translates literally to falcons. And so these are people that are just watching who is coming and going. And we saw this a lot in places where drug trafficking had a very strong interest in migrants. They want to see who's coming, typically have a radio where they would communicate with people about what's happening. You would see them very openly operating. Enganchadores are, you know, enganchar is to hook. So they kind of are in charge of catching migrants. And so a lot of them would be essentially offering people the services of a coyote or a human smuggler to get across the border. But the challenge is you don't know which ones are legitimately offering that to people who want to cross the border and which ones are actually there to try and kidnap people. And so often you'll see people that would go with a enganchador and they would end up being kidnapped and ransomed rather than cross the border. And this happens so much because everyone knows that people have family in the United States who can come up with that money, especially if they're planning to cross the border anyway. That means they probably have $2,000 or $3,000 that they're planning on paying a smuggler that can just be taken as ransom. And so this process has become increasingly common along the border, and it makes things much, much more dangerous.
What were the things that identified people to the people who would kidnap them as higher value kidnappees?
Well, they're looking for people that have more time in the U.S., more connections to the United States. That's typically seen as being more valuable. So they're looking for people that the brands of their clothes might be from the United States. They're looking for people, even hairstyles, mannerisms. They're listening to speech, people whose Spanish isn't very good or whose Spanish has been kind of anglicized, which you'll hear a lot of. You know, different words being used from Mexican-American type of Spanish, even after a short period in the United States. And so Mexico is a pretty linguistically puritanical country, and they're really good at picking out those accents, that intonation. And so those are really the people that they're kind of looking for in terms of, okay, this person would be a good target. On the other hand, they're often looking for people who might have been born in the territory of an enemy cartel as a potential threat. So, you know, some of the experiences that were very scary is people that were, say, born in Michoacán or Sinaloa would get kidnapped and interrogated by the cartels or police and tortured simply to find out whether or not this person was actually working as a spy for a rival cartel. And that puts people in a very dangerous position simply based on the randomness of geography.
So you introduce us to Juanito. He told you his story. Can you give us a sketch of what he went through?
Yes, this is a young man who was deported to Chihuahua and kidnapped by Mexican agents or people that were pretending to be Mexican agents. He was never able to fully determine this and held for 6 months in San Fernando, in the place where this massacre happened. And you know, his story really shows that what they're doing is they're asking for ransom, but they're not really letting people go when they pay ransom. And so he was made to work for them for many months, typically packaging marijuana, cutting marijuana, pollinating, and trying to grow these plants, as well as other industries such as organ harvesting of children. So he was exposed to a lot of this violence as somebody that they had coerced to work with them, and eventually was able to escape when they trusted him enough to take drugs across the border, and he was able to flag down Border Patrol agents. And, you know, his story really gives us some depth of insight into why would you kidnap tens of thousands of people who are relatively poor.
We have a question here from listener Michael, who phoned it in and then got off the phone. He was on I-5 driving. He wants to know if you think a wall might be effective in keeping out drugs, not necessarily the immigrants, but the drugs anyway.
No, not at all. So drugs really, in the vast majority, come right through the front door.
Right in through the way stations, the entry points.
Right, the port of entry, so as it's known. Because, you know, we have so much trade going on with Mexico. It's very difficult to have almost complete open borders for goods, but to select out certain types of materials that can't go through. So sorting through all that legal cargo and finding drugs is really the biggest issue. A lot of what comes between ports of entry is marijuana, which is, you know, kind of a dying industry for Mexican drug cartels. Typically now what it's being used for is to kind of mix in with higher quality U.S. product, you know, essentially to cut the good marijuana that's being produced in, you know, places inside the United States. So the reason for that was is that marijuana is so bulky, right? You can take it through the desert, you can lose most of it,
it's better, it's easier. Whereas when you hide marijuana inside of a tractor trailer, it's easier to find than, you know, a 2-pound package of heroin or cocaine, which is much, much more valuable.
I want to get into the three deaths of deportation that you make us aware of in the book. Ambiguous death. Let's start with ambiguous death and social death and the differences between them.
So ambiguous death, what I'm discussing is this idea when you don't quite know what happens to people. And this is something that plagues a lot of families whose loved ones cross the border and die or disappear, and we never quite hear from them. One of the things that I'm trying to explore in this book, too, is how much of that ambiguity do we attribute to the fact that there is so much violence in many of these regions. There's so many of these clandestine graves that get found. And there's also a lot of danger in actually asking and looking for people's loved ones. I give the story of a young woman who's looking for her father and finding absolutely no police records. Everything that they reported is essentially gone. There's no record of this individual. And getting the message that if you keep looking, this is going to be dangerous for you. And so there's an ambiguity surrounding death when people are afraid to even search for answers.
And then social death?
And social death is where we discuss a lot of the stigma, right? The idea that you as a person don't have access to these rights. It's this being out of place, this being a deportee or a migrant in these border cities where you are exposed to a level of violence that other people are not, that there isn't the appropriate level of care, basically, around the humanity of people that are engaging in migration. The migrant is always somebody that can be blamed. They're always defined as either going to or being from somewhere else. This kind of constant notion that this is a foreigner and therefore doesn't deserve the respect that other people do.
Huh. And on both sides of the border, that situation.
It's true.
Sure.
Yes.
And then there's a third category here, which kind of boggles the mind, the idea of dead bodies with rights that they don't have when they're alive.
Yeah, so I discussed the issue of deported veterans here, which is, I think is something that we really need to pay more attention to, you know, up throughout the country. That we have perhaps thousands, it's hard to know for sure, of people who served in the U.S. military but were deported afterwards. Typically what happens is you can serve in the military if you're a legal permanent resident and you're allowed to naturalize. But sometimes that process is more complicated, or sometimes people don't get around to doing it, often because they think that they served in the military and therefore they are U.S. citizens. And then once somebody gets in trouble, a lot of, as veterans are, it's common to have happened for them to get arrested for certain issues. And then they figure out, oh, not only do I have to go to prison, but now I'm going to be deported. And so you have this group of people that feels an intense sense of betrayal, right? Having served the United States, having thought that they were part of that country that they served, and yet they've been deported. And so what we saw many times is a lot of these older individuals who had served in Vietnam, when they died, they're allowed to be buried in a military cemetery. And so they're asked if they would want the body sent to the United States, even though during life they were consistently denied access to their VA benefits, access to health care, and not allowed to cross the border. And so this becomes another example of the deep irony of the way we deal with the border and death.
Well, in the 30 seconds we have left, I want to ask you to solve the problem, but tell us what your next step in research is, Jeremy.
Well, right now I'm trying to do some work around this issue of the Remain in Mexico policy. This is essentially where people come to the U.S., asylum seekers declare that they're afraid to return to their home country, and they're being sent to wait in Mexican border cities. I'm trying to provide some statistical information about what does that do? What happens to people once they're made to wait in these cities that are notorious for crime and violence? Is this a safe policy? I mean, it has this strange name of the Migrant Protection Protocol, but I think it's pretty clear that it much more fits, as we were discussing earlier, into this idea of creating consequences for people who are trying to migrate.
Right.
And so that's really what I'm trying to do, is see how this situation is evolving when you add tens of thousands of Central Americans, Cubans, Venezuelans into that mix.
It is a big mess. We really get our eyes open in the book, Deported to Death, How Drug Violence is Changing Migration on the U.S.-Mexico Border. Jeremy Slack wrote it and joined us today in The Exchange. Jeremy, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.